Hey, everybody. It's me, W. Kamau Bell. Welcome back to the ACLU's podcast, At Liberty. Every episode, I'm asking the big questions on the big issues affecting our country, especially our hardest hit and most vulnerable communities. And I'm calling on experts from the ACLU and beyond for their much-needed guidance. Last episode, we turned our attention to roads, highways, and bridges, and what they can tell us about inequality in the United States. Turns out that's a lot. Today, we're building, pun intended, on our Know Your Rights series with a conversation about digital privacy. Picture it. You've just wrapped up a work trip or maybe a family vacation, and you're headed back to the U.S. Your plane lands, and you feel a sense of relief. Almost home. As you approach border control, you take out your passport. Maybe you scroll through Instagram or check the weather. Finally, you're in front of a border agent, and they ask you to hand over your phone. Your mind goes to that Trump meme you saved to your camera roll, to the trans influencer you follow, to the episode of At Liberty that you shared with a friend. And then it hits you. Am I going to be okay? It feels like every day now we're hearing about a new encounter with border agents. We've seen a French scientist denied U.S. entry on his way to a conference, a doctor on an H-1B visa deported to Lebanon, and we've seen headlines and TikToks urging U.S. citizens and non-citizens alike to seek out burner phones, encryption, and other protective measures. If you found yourself doom scrolling, you've come to the right place. All right, let's take a breath. You've got this, and the ACLU's got you. Let's get into it. Joining us today, we have two new recruits from our WKB ACLU Special Correspondent Task Force. Aisha Bhandari is Deputy Director of the ACLU Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. She works to protect freedom of expression and privacy rights in the digital age. And Daniel Kahn Gilmore, or rather DKG, is a Senior Staff Technologist for ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. He's focused on the way our technical infrastructure shapes society and impacts civil liberties. And if you were curious, his OpenPGP fingerprint is 888E6BEA C419-5926-9EAA-177F138F5AB6-8615C560. Easy to remember. And now, on to the guests. Thank you, first of all, for coming. I'm going to start by telling you a story that I think happens to many Americans, where you get an email from Google saying three of your passwords have been compromised. And then it says, click on this link. And I go, is this real? Is this not real? Should I click on this link? I don't really want to change my passwords. I'm going to pretend like it's fake. And I keep it moving. Tell me where you think most Americans are just generally with this whole idea of their digital lives and safety and security. I'll start with you, DKG.
So first off, I wouldn't click that link if that's the email that I get.
Okay.
I think everyone is struggling. You know, we've moved most of our lives online. Everybody that I know who uses the internet probably has at least a dozen accounts. Some of us have probably hundreds. And it's hard to keep track of that stuff. In a lot of situations, we depend on external providers, commercial providers who are giving us services that are free, supposedly, gratis. It's hard to keep track. And nobody wants to change their passwords. You know, that's a major pain. And we don't really know how to manage them well individually. But it turns out that if you're storing your data on other people's computers, you need to think about how that stuff gets managed. And there are some things you can do to make that easier. But for most people, there's a level of inertia that you have to get past to start taking this stuff more seriously. And I think we all owe it to each other to do that.
I think, DKG, I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on privacy by default, because I agree, you know, DKG is an expert on this. He knows what to do. He's actually someone who's motivated and an expert and knows how to clean up his digital house. But most of us, and I include myself as a lawyer who works on privacy issues, but I'm still not an expert on how to clean up my digital house. And so I'm just doing the best I can, right? If I occasionally see something that I can obviously, protect my information in this way, opt out of something, I'll do it. But we're all busy. I'm not able to do it across the board. My information's in places that I wish it wasn't. I wish I could go back and then get my data back from places that I gave it to before I was aware of issues. So I'd love to hear DKG's thoughts about, you know, why we push for privacy by default in context, so we don't put this burden on individual people to be fixing this mess.
I appreciate you actually just taking over the interviewing. I'm totally kidding. I appreciate it. Like, yes. So DKG, answer my co-host questions.
Right. So it's more than we shouldn't put the responsibility on the individual, right? Aisha, you and I have exchanged emails, right? So whatever decisions you've made about how you keep track of your emails, those have an impact on my privacy. And similarly, like, you know, you've sent me emails, I've got copies of those messages. So there's things about you that are stored on my devices. And so it's not even just like we don't want to put the pressure on the individual to take care of their own privacy. The fact is, everybody is sort of mutually responsible for the information of everybody else that they're in touch with. And that's a really heavy responsibility. And so what we really want to have happen, also people have other things to do than manage their privacy, right? How many times have you visited a website and it says, you know, opt out? And if you click opt out, it takes you away from the thing you were trying to do. And nobody's got time for that. So we just say accept because I know it'll let me finish what I'm trying to do, right? Those situations where you're put in a situation where you're sort of forced to make a decision about, am I going to get the thing done that I was trying to get done? Or am I going to take the information privacy and security more seriously and maybe delay what I do? Those are things that pressure us to not take that stuff seriously. So what we really need is we need systems that are easy to use, that make the private option the easy thing to do and make the mistake option the harder thing to do. And so that's why we need to be building systems and adopting systems and encouraging people to use those systems that make those decisions automatically and by default. And you know, there's a couple of different ways that you can think about how an information system is going to be private by default. One of the core questions that I often ask when I'm looking at a system, if I care about privacy for that conversation or for that, you know, work product or, you know, project that I'm building or something, is about whether or not there's a middleman in the conversation who gets access to all the information. At this interview right now, we're recording on a platform that has a middleman because the point is to produce something that's public. So ultimately, like, I expect the producers of this podcast, I expect, you know, both of you to be able to review what happens. I'm not that worried that this is going to leak because the goal is to leak it. But if we're just having a private conversation separately, I want to make sure that there's no middleman who gets a copy of it. So, you know, when I send Aisha an email, I happen to know that our mail provider that receives message from me and the mail provider that stores the message for Aisha gets a copy of that email. And that means that Aisha and I can do everything we can on our sides, but there's still that middleman, and the middleman has to decide what to do with the data. On the flip side, there are some systems we can use that are what we call end-to-end encrypted, where the contents of the messages are only visible to the folks who are on either side, and whoever's in the middle transferring the stuff back and forth, they only see an encrypted version. They only see sort of the what we call the ciphertext, which means just the, you know, it looks like gibberish if you don't have the keys to unlock it. And the keys reside only at the endpoints. So using a simple system, you know, Signal Private Messenger has been in the news a lot lately. And people have been kind of freaking out about its use in some ways that are legitimate freakouts and in some ways that are not. But that's an example of a system where the folks who operate that service, Signal, have tied their hands so that they cannot see the contents of those messages. And that's a deliberate choice that Signal made. They said, we want to offer private communications to anyone who wants to do it, whether they are warmongers or activists. You know, we want to make sure that it's not up to us to be able to see the contents of that. And so, and a system like Signal is relatively easy to use, but you still do have to pay some attention, right? You don't want to add the journalist to your war crimes chat.
It can't protect you from yourself is what you're
right,
saying.
Right. So there are things that we do need people to step up and be responsible for. But really, there's another big question is how do we make sure that the infrastructure that we depend on is by default doing the right thing, right? We don't want the user to have to worry that they're going to send mail through Outlook to talk to a journalist about the new upcoming version of Windows and then find out that the folks who own Outlook, which is Microsoft, are the same folks who make Windows, and then they're going to go after the person by crawling through their email box. You know, that would be a mistake. That has happened.
Aisha, first of all, I'm going to be clear. You can ask questions. Anybody can ask questions anytime they want to. I came a little hot. I was really just, I'm enjoying the back and forth, and I like the fact that you two know each other. So you can both help me with things that I don't know, because I'm really just a passenger here. And again, like someone who like is all, like you say, like it says, when it says accept all cookies and you're like, no, and then it takes you to another page. You're like, okay, I get it. I'll accept all cookies. So let's talk about a little bit what brings you each to this work. Aisha, what brings you to this work as someone who wants to talk about and protect digital privacy?
Digital privacy is just a foundation for protecting human rights. It's what allows us to organize. It's what allows us to debate ideas. It allows people to be a minority voice in a society, maybe pushing unpopular ideas or ideas that their governments or people in power don't like. So to me, as someone who's always cared about human rights and I care about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, digital privacy goes hand in hand with that. It's very hard to have a free society with no private space in which we're under constant surveillance and everything we say and do is monitored, recorded, and stored somewhere. So that to me is just the basic principle. We need to have some space to operate free from the eyes of Big Brother.
And what about you, DKG? What brings you to this fight?
Aisha, I think, said it very well. Like, the goal is the mission here, right? But there's a question about what society we want to live in. And a society where you can't have a private conversation is a society where you can't decide to change your mind, right? It's a society where you can't try out an unpopular opinion, where you have to be the exact same person to everyone in your life, which most people are not. Right? I mean, if every conversation that you had with your partner was shared with your boss, it would be awkward. And if every single conversation that you had with your boss was shared with your business competitor, that would also be awkward, right? We all need different ways, you know, to be able to communicate and to be able to work in the world. And the strange thing about our communications infrastructure is that we've had this incredible leap where almost all of our communications today are mediated through a technical network. And that network is not controlled by us, right? It is controlled by very large organizations that may or may not know what's going on with you, and they may not have your interests in mind. It used to be that when you would meet with your friends and you'd like plan something, you would actually do it in person. And those conversations would not be recorded anywhere. There would be no way to make a copy. And today, that's not the case. Most of our conversations are mediated through these devices and through these networks. And if we aren't careful about how we structure them, then it gives the operators of the networks and the operators of the devices, and the vendors of the devices that we use, it gives them a tremendous amount of power over what it's possible to express and you know, what kind of a society we could potentially build going forward.
Well, yeah, and I think everything you're saying, I totally understand. And the other part of this is that you didn't also used to keep a record of everything you ever said. You know, even if you wrote somebody a letter, they threw that letter away eventually, unless it was a really good letter. You know what I mean? Like, now we have these devices in our pockets or in our laptops where all of your communication with everyone you're communicating with is kept forever. And, you know, there's even this idea of the group chat being this sort of private place where, you know, everybody has a group chat with their friends where you may say things in the group chat that you're not going to say out loud, but you're still keeping a record of these things in your phone. And if somebody says, hand me your phone, you have the moment of like, you're like, hold on a second. Let me, you know, that brings us to this idea of law enforcement officials asking to search your phone, or, you know, these border searches where people come to the border and somebody's asked, well, let me see your phone. And you sort of, I always say, like, I know what my rights are, but when a law enforcement official asks me for something, even if I know that's not within my rights or that's not within their rights to ask me, I'm like, you know what I mean? So let's talk about that part of it and connect it to these border searches.
Yeah. I mean, The question of border device searches right now is hotly contested. And the reason it's hotly contested is because the government's claiming this very sweeping authority to search everyone's phones just because they travel internationally with no requirement of getting a warrant. And warrants are really important, just to get back to basics. They're really important because a warrant is issued by a judge who's supposed to operate as a neutral arbiter, right? Someone who's not in the heat of operational decisions, who's not like fully invested in an investigation that's going on. And they can take a look and say, do you actually really need the information on this device? Because it's so invasive of privacy, we want to have that check, that outside person. But the government says, no. If you travel on the border, we can look at your device and we can look at it without any individualized suspicion whatsoever. And I think the, you know, we've been working really hard in the courts to, you know, try to make sure that the constitutional limitations of a warrant do apply at the border. And at the very least, even if a warrant isn't required, that there's some reasonable suspicion and that the reasonable suspicion be limited to what we would call digital contraband, meaning you're looking only for things on a device that aren't allowed to be brought into the country. Nothing else. Not going on a fishing expedition. And I think the privacy invasion is in some senses intuitive, but you know, we do spell it out, right? But you just said this, right? You said this. It's everything you've possibly ever thought or said since you first got a phone, which since people are getting phones increasingly younger, I mean, might be since you were, you know, in elementary school, maybe middle school, right? Mm-hmm. Everything you've searched, for some people that's all contained on a device that they can carry on them. And the idea that a law enforcement official, you know, a border official could go through this and just go on a fishing expedition, really, and find out all kinds of things about you, that's really not what the Constitution permits. It's not necessary for them to do their jobs at the border, right? It's not necessary, and it's so highly invasive. And the way I think when I'm talking about this issue, whether it's in courts or to other people, is just to say, I mean, if I said to you right now, give me your phone, I'm going to take it away for a couple hours. I'm just going to go through it. Just give me your phone. Don't change anything. Don't delete anything. All of the recent photos you took, all the chats you had, just give it to me. I'm going to take it for a couple hours and come back. How would you feel about that? And I'm not even a border official who has the power to make decisions about your life and your liberty. I'm just a person. But I'm like, give me your phone for a couple hours. And then now imagine the power of the state saying, give me your phone.
Yeah, I think to answer your question, I think I'd pull Tom Brady and be like, oh, I broke that phone.
Or like you,
Tom Brady,
like
during,
Agatha Christie, during dropped it over a boat in the ocean somewhere. Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Just lost that.
Yeah. I've always wanted to do that thing I see in movies where the guy takes his phone and like breaks it and throws it in the trash. I think that would be what I would do, although it would be hard to break my iPhone personally and physically. But yeah, so I think the thing you're saying is right, is that like just the idea of somebody going through your phone, even if you really believe, and I'm putting scare quotes here, you have nothing to hide, you still are like, but I don't want you to know. even if I think I don't have anything to hide, there's still things I just don't feel comfortable with anybody, with everybody seeing. Yeah.
I mean, how many people would even be comfortable giving their phone just unfettered to their family members, right? That we even have a degree of privacy vis-a-vis your partner or your spouse or your kids or your parents or even the people you are closest to who you have your best interests in mind. I don't know too many people who would say, well, there's nothing on my phone that I wouldn't want to keep private.
Yeah. Exactly. I remember just a quick aside, and I'll go to you, DKG. My wife comes from a big family where there's a lack of privacy, and I'm an only child, and it was just me and my mom with a lot of privacy. And then we got to the point of being close. She's like, what's your password to your phone? And I was like, whoa, like, wait a minute. And again, I don't think I had anything to hide, but it just felt like I don't want you to just have it. You know, if you want to see it, I'll open it for you. And, you know, but yeah, so it is a big deal. DKG.
I just wanted to, you know, just to add that it's, you know, it's not just whether you have something to hide, right? Because you have information on your device about people around you, right? You have photos of you with your friends. Mm. And do you know the immigration status of all your friends? Do you know what would be damaging for them? Have you had that conversation? Those are awkward conversations to have. And you don't necessarily know those things, and maybe there's stuff on your device that would hurt them, right? And so when you're asked, you know, when someone asks, can I see your phone? And as Aisha says, you know, they're operating with the authority of the state, you're really giving them a tremendous amount of potential power, even if you yourself are not under threat.
That is something I had not thought about, and I don't know that most people think about that it's not necessarily about you having something to hide. It's about all the people you're connected to and you not knowing what they have to hide or what they don't want people to know.
I administer some computer systems, and that means that I have some passwords on some of my devices that give me the ability to modify the way some computer systems work. Most people don't have that particular responsibility, but you probably have other responsibilities. If I was to just give access to my device to somebody else, and they were to get a copy of, say, the contents of my password manager as a result, they could do a tremendous amount of damage to people unrelated to me. I mean, they're related to me by the fact that I happen to administer a system that they depend on, right? But you probably have something like that in your, you know, because you probably are responsible for other things that may not be, you know, computer related, but there might be, you know, but there might be, I don't know, plans for your business. There might be, you know, your kids' grades. They might be your partner's medical records, right? Like those things could be there.
So let's talk about the searches, because you've talked about how are the searches allowed, and why is it that they are allowed, or are they allowed, or people just are law enforcement just using their sort of like weight as law enforcement, and you know, is this a violation of our First Amendment rights? Like just into the basics of how these searches are allowed.
Yeah, so the government is searching devices at the border essentially because it can right now. In the absence of binding authority around the country that says that it violates the Constitution. We argue repeatedly in the courts that it does violate the Constitution, in particular, the Fourth Amendment, which requires a warrant for searches of devices because they're so invasive of privacy. Now, there have been some circuit court of appeals, which are the federal appellate courts, which have jurisdiction over multiple states, that have imposed some limits on them. So the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers states like Virginia, you know, it requires that device searches be limited to, you know, looking for evidence of cross-border crime. And that if you do sort of forensic searches, which are when you plug in a device to a phone, that you have reasonable suspicion. And in the Ninth Circuit, which covers California, Alaska, and nearby states, you can only do a search if you are looking for digital contraband, which really limits the scope of what officers can search for. So they can't just be looking at your call log to see who you called recently, because that's not going to be containing anything that could be considered digital contraband that can't be brought into the country. That's just evidence. That's just fishing expeditions. So in those circuits, there are limitations. They don't go as far as we would like. We think that, you know, the Supreme Court needs to ultimately weigh in and say that, look, you need a warrant. And if and when the Supreme Court does weigh in, then you'd have binding precedent for the whole country. But instead, what you have now is this sort of period where the government's trying to push the authority it has as far as it can. Instead of waiting for courts to bless what it is doing and saying, yes, this surveillance technique or this searches of electronic devices is permissible, they're instead taking the approach of let's do it and wait for a court to tell us not to. And we see this a lot with surveillance technology and the adoption of new technology, where government and law enforcement will say, we'll do it first and find out later if it's unconstitutional, rather than let's find out first from the courts if it's constitutional before we start, you know, pushing the limits with these novel surveillance techniques. So where does this leave people traveling? Unfortunately, it means you've got to take some self-help because you will be subject to the rules as they are currently applied by the government. And that means people coming to the United States, visitors, non-citizens, and citizens are subject to possibly having their devices searched without suspicion. So we have put out some guidance. We've been advising people. We've been getting a lot of inquiries about this because there's obviously a climate now of concern about harsher questioning and searches at the border. But self-help is really the best way for people to go, taking some precautions. And I can talk more about those. But we're in this period where I think, you know, the government is really doing searches that are unconstitutional, but because it hasn't been told definitively in every place that it can't.
So yeah, I think let's jump into those precautions. I think everybody's like, well, what do I need to do if I am traveling?
I'll say that the first thing is, if you don't have information on you when you cross the border, they can't search it. So one thing to think about is, what do you need to travel with? And I'm not naive enough to think that people are going to be comfortable traveling with no digital device today. You know, most people can't find their way out of a wet paper bag without the navigation apps on their devices, right? I mean, we've gotten very accustomed to them. Maybe there's some stuff you don't need to carry. Like, you have that USB stick that has, you know, a bunch of your old files on it. Maybe you leave that at home. Don't travel with it, right? You have an old laptop that you probably aren't going to use, but maybe it'll come in handy on the trip. Maybe don't travel with it. So there's one basic thing of just like minimize how much you're carrying across the border. That's at a baseline. Secondly, I'd say for everything that you are carrying across the border, I recommend that you make sure that it's fully encrypted. And again, I mentioned encryption earlier. In this case, we're talking about storage encryption. So your devices need to be encrypted. And the encryption is generally only as good as your device's password. So if you have a phone and it's, you know, modern Android and iOS are both encrypted by default, which is good. But if your password is 0000, that's not that great. You know, we can just guess it and unlock
Same with 1234. Not a great password.
There's only, man, you guys are wiping out all my passwords.
And 9999 is not so good either, right? But there's only 10,000 four-digit passwords. And if you try one password per second, that's about 4 hours to try all of them. And the folks who are going to be guessing at passwords are going to be using automated guessing techniques. And we have some defenses against that. But the point is, strong, unguessable passwords are preferable to short passwords. And that matters because those passwords are really ultimately what controls the encryption on your device. You want to make sure your device is not unlockable with your biometrics when you cross. And the easiest way to do that is to ensure your device is fully off. Because if someone takes your device and it's in a mode where it can be unlocked with your fingerprint, and let's say those folks happen to have your hands cuffed behind your back, then they can take your fingerprint and apply it to the sensor and unlock the device, right? If it unlocks with a view of your face and they hold it in front of your face, it can be unlocked, even if you don't mean it to be unlocked. So fully off is the most secure way to go if you want to make sure that the devices aren't scanned without your knowledge. But it does mean that somebody is then there. You may be in a position where the Border Patrol asks you for your password and tells you, you need to unlock this, power it up and unlock it. Aisha, you want to talk about that scenario? Cause that's a tough scenario.
Sure.
You just went to like, I need a lawyer. Like you just
went to the. Exactly. And that is a tough scenario. And I think the responses that people give will often depend on their immigration status and just their tolerance for possibly having their devices taken from them or being held up at the border a little bit longer. People who are citizens can't be denied entry to the country for refusing to give a password. You have an entitlement to come back. So if you say, no, I'm not going to provide a password. And by the way, CBP, which is the border agency, they have, sort of buried in some policies, acknowledge that people can't be forced to give passwords in this circumstance. But, you know, if you choose to stand on your rights, they have to let you in eventually, but they might keep your devices to try to crack the code later. So again, thinking about your own personal risk reward, how much do you need those devices for daily work and living? Some people will choose to give the password and some will not. For those who do choose to help with unlocking, we always recommend putting in the password yourself rather than giving it to an officer. And also recommend just saying very calmly that you're not consenting to the search, that just because you've decided to assist with unlocking it because you have your reasons, that you're still not consenting to the search. This is not something you're doing willingly. And for people who aren't citizens, I think the calculus can shift a little bit, particularly people who are visitors on visitor visas or from visa waiver countries who can be denied entry to the country. You do risk that if you don't assist with unlocking your device and enabling a search, that you might be turned away from the country. So again, these are personal risk reward calculuses that people have to take. And for people who are in the boat where I'm visiting the United States and I need to be able to come in, for those people, I think it is particularly important then to be traveling with as little data as possible on your device so that if you are in a position where you have to provide a password or unlock it, you know, you're not opening up your whole life for inspection. And by the way, there is no requirement that people cross the border with any specific piece of digital data. That's very important. There's nothing in the law that says you must be traveling with all of your, you know, digital history, your personal emails, your photos. There is no such requirement. And in fact, the government, by its own policy, is not supposed to search information in the cloud. So if you've got cloud-based data, all of that should be off limits for search. And so another thing you can do to protect yourself is move as much as you can off your devices into cloud storage. Put your devices into airplane mode with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth off. Although, as DKG said, turning them off entirely is the best practice. But again, just keep things in the cloud because the government by its own policy says we cannot search cloud data because that's not meaningfully being carried across the border with you. Now, there are technical issues with what remains on your device, which DKG, I'm sure, will chime in on.
I wanted to chime in on the like move stuff to the cloud because the government says that they're not allowed to search it at the border because it's in the cloud. But there's different ways you can put data in the cloud. As we talked about earlier, you can put data in the cloud so that it's encrypted and the cloud provider can't read it. Or you can put data in the cloud where there's a copy that the cloud provider can read. And while Border Patrol might not claim the right to search stuff that's in the cloud, they may, in some other context or other agencies themselves, may go to the cloud provider and say, hey, we'd like to see the copy of Kamau's cloud storage. So that's a separate issue. So if you're going to move stuff from your device and put it in the cloud, right, both remove it from, like, put it in the cloud and remove the copy that's still on your device, try to put it in the cloud in a cloud storage that is end-to-end encrypted. So that is, again, where the provider, like the signal operators, has ruled themselves out of being able to provide access to the contents. Now, how do you ensure that data is actually fully removed from your device? Because, you know, just putting a copy in the end-to-end encrypted cloud doesn't do the trick, right? You have to actually also remove the copy from your local device. So what does it mean to remove the copy from the local device? Let's say you've got a messaging app, like WhatsApp or Signal, and you remove that app. That doesn't necessarily remove the messages from the app. It might just remove the interface to the app. And so you do need to think about whether or not you're able to get rid of all of the messages, you know, all of the storage for the app in addition to the interface, right? If someone's just browsing through it with their thumbs, they won't see how to get to it. But if they plug the device in and do what Aisha called a forensic search, then they may still find the archive of all of those chats that's just sitting there on the device. And so that actually depends on a per app basis, how you make sure that it's been properly removed.
And I do want to say, all of these are just, these are suggestions, but they fall on a spectrum of risk reward, right? If you're a journalist who does, you know, reporting that is highly adversarial to the government, I'm guessing you're going to want to be on the highest end of all of the precautions that you take. If you're someone who's never been subject to border questioning or searches before, and you don't do anything that you think will be of particular interest, maybe you can take the easier precautions because it's harder for you to do like a full digital deep clean. But, you know, taking basic precautions is still worthwhile in case you are subject to search and you know, you do the best you can. So I think people shouldn't feel overwhelmed by the fact that you may not be able to do all of it. Maybe you can't come up with a perfectly clean laptop or device to travel with. But evaluate where you are on the risk spectrum, evaluate your comfort level with the stuff you've got on your devices that you travel with. And even taking some of the steps can be helpful. So don't feel like everything's got to be all or nothing.
Every step you take is helpful, right? And you're not going to get to perfection. I'm traveling today and I didn't travel with zero devices. I had to bring some devices with me, you know, and I had to bring the information for how to get on this podcast, you know? So like, you're not going to get to perfection. But every step that you take to clear data off is, you know, one more friend of yours who's not going to have evidence used against them because it was pulled off of your device. Every step that you take is going to be one less piece of metadata that they managed to harvest to build out the social network of, you know, your affinity group for activism. So, you know, each step you take is worth it, even if you can't get all the way there.
The thing that occurs to me now is like, I've certainly heard these commercials. This is now a way for companies to say, we will protect your data. And you see these companies out there. And again, that's another like, I mean, I like this podcast, but I don't know if I trust this podcast host to know that this is the right company to protect my data, you know? So I think that's another level of confusion. I'm not necessarily asking you to recommend apps. Like, I know I'm not trying to put, but are there things out there that you think can help people when you think about somebody who's like not the journalist who's like trying to, who knows they need to be on the higher end, but somebody who's like, I got opinions about things and I don't want everybody to know what I'm doing. Are there ways out there for you to sort of find easier ways to sort of like plug into apps or programs that can help you sort of do it so you're not up trying to be the next Edward Snowden trying to figure out how to get, you know, or trying to figure out how to encrypt things, you know?
So the good news is that you already have a lot of that stuff available to you. You probably just don't use it very often. Mm. I like to say that there's the folks who are not super tech savvy avoid installing new apps. The folks who are more tech savvy like to install new apps. And the folks who are the most tech savvy are the ones who like to uninstall apps. You can just go through your device and look and see what's on there and say, hey, don't need that, don't need that, don't need that, right? There's ways to just uninstall what's on there. Again, that might not get you all the way through on the forensic search, but as a starter, if there's things that you decide you don't need, just pull them off the device, right? That's already available to you. As a preemptive thing, you can, in your if you have a chat app, most modern end-to-end encrypted messaging apps like WhatsApp, like Signal, have disappearing messages as a feature, you can just turn that on. And so your group chat, the one you were talking about, Kamau, that, you know, goes back to, you know, mm-hmm. you know, your whatever, your college shenanigans, you know, days,
yes.
If that is, only retains messages for 4 weeks, whenever you cross the border, only the shenanigans that are 4 weeks young are gonna show up. So, that's right. You know, you can turn those on today and know that that's given you some level of protection. You don't even have to think about it just before you travel because you've already got those. Now that means that you don't have the full archive. You know, that's a trade-off, but that may be the responsible trade-off to make. And, you know, it used to be your friend told you a joke and you thought it was hilarious and that was that. And maybe we need to be thinking about getting back there.
You didn't feel like, I will hold on to this joke until right, I die. Right. You didn't. That wasn't what you thought. Yeah. So let's talk about the couple of cases that have come up recently. There's a French scientist who was denied U.S. entry on his way to a conference. And then there's a doctor on an H-1B visa who was deported to Lebanon. What do we know about those cases? And what are your thoughts?
Regardless of how the facts shake out in those cases, and of course, the government is going to defend its decisions there, but the widespread reporting on those cases demonstrates the climate of fear. And I am seeing so many articles written in publications in other countries around the world about what should you do if you're going to visit the United States? Are you welcome there? Is some, you know, random border officer going to see something on your phone that they completely misinterpret and ruin your life, right? Ruin your plans, you know, completely upend things for you. And to me, I think that just goes to show how problematic these unfettered searches are, because it's one thing to say, you know, we got a warrant and we're looking for a very particular limited thing for something we're investigating. But if you're just rummaging through, think about how much is subject to misinterpretation. Think about how much is going to be seen out of context. Think about, you know, mm-hmm. you read a social media post that's written in a different language and you hit translate and it doesn't even make sense, but you think it's saying something it's not saying. Think about, you know, photos and symbols and signs and humor in different cultures and how poorly equipped an individual officer looking at a device would be to interpret those. And so what's going to happen if you have this unfettered search authority at the border? You're going to have people making decisions on the basis of things they shouldn't be making decisions on. And they might even think sincerely, oh, this is an important distinction. I've discovered something about this person that says they shouldn't be coming to America because there's something bad about them. But they're wrong, or they've completely misunderstood, or they shouldn't even have access to that kind of like deep inner thought process of people, right? I mean, just think about, you know, how many people come to the United States with stuff on their devices about their political opinions. And, you know, we all probably have conversations where we've talked about what our views about this government, other governments. That's not supposed to be a basis mm-hmm. for excluding someone, right? It's not supposed to be that if you come to the United States and you have any, you know, thoughts on whatever politician or whatever policy, that should be even a factor. But of course, if border officers have access to that information, they are going to start abusing that information and making decisions on these things that they should never have known in the first place. And so you kind of get this slippery slope then. It's they shouldn't have had access to that information anyway. But then once they have access to that information, they're going to start making decisions about who to exclude on the basis of these factors that they never should have considered. So I think people are afraid. This conversation is happening much more in the last couple of months than it has been. Even though device searches, by the way, have been on the rise for many, many years through the Biden administration, through the first Trump administration, through the Obama administration. These device searches have been done across administrations and they've been rising across administrations. But I think we're seeing renewed attention now because of this sense that the government might use these impermissible factors, these impermissible reasons to exclude people just because they don't like how they think or express themselves.
I think, you know, in addition to the way that the individual agents at the border deal with this stuff, to the extent that the searches are being done as forensic searches, where the contents of the device is sort of slurped out and shoveled into some CBP database, we don't know how long that database will last. And we don't know what that database will be used for in the future. So even if you don't get excluded from entry at the time, you know, one of the big risks of the device searches is that they're basically just building, they could be building a big dossier that they're searching for arbitrary things, and we don't know how to stop that from happening. So that's another way that it can be problematic.
The other thing I'd add is I think the United States is just, it's setting a terrible example for the rest of the world and kind of leading a race to the bottom, a race to the floor here. Because think about this policy adopted by every government in the world. It would mean that we all lose our human right to privacy just because we travel. And it means that when you come back to the United States, you might be subject to suspicionless searches. If you go to other countries, you might be subject to suspicionless searches. In fact, you know, if there's no claim to privacy rights that apply at all, essentially, you know, we have to submit to being an open book just to be able to have freedom of movement, right? To visit people we love, to travel, to do business abroad. I mean, everything, right? So I think what we're seeing is an unfortunate race to the bottom where you've got a country that's supposed to protect basic fundamental human rights doing these kinds of searches. And, you know, if this becomes the norm and accepted as just the cost of traveling, well, then every country in the world adopting this means there's nowhere to travel or to go where you can be free from this kind of surveillance.
So that takes me to, are we really at a place where, and I sort of made this joke earlier about like, if you're traveling back into the country or if you're traveling and you know you're going to be, if you know you're going through an airport, you should get a burner phone. Are we really, are we at a place where like, I feel like I've only seen it in movies, but the idea of like some sort of like flip phone style device that, is that a thing that you recommend or a thing that, that you feel more people are doing?
I mean, a burner phone doesn't need to be a flip phone. And it could just be that you have a travel phone. Right. Maybe it's not a burner, you know, the, in the classic stories and, you know, in the real like, you know, the movie plots, we get the phone, we just use it once and then we snap it in half, like you were saying. Right. But maybe you decide when you're going to travel, you're going to get a travel phone and you'll have a separate travel identity. Why do you have the phone? You have it for navigation apps. So you install a navigation app and you want to be able to talk to the folks that you're coming to meet and some folks back home for safety purposes. And so you know, the phone now has three things on it, right? It has your travel itinerary and a travel app. It has your contacts with the folks that you're going to meet, and it has your contacts with the folks that you're going to. And then as long as you tell your friends ahead of time this is what you're doing, they don't expect to be messaging you on your old phone. You leave your old phone at home, you bring the new one. Now that's not everyone can afford a new phone. You know, that's a big ask too. But that's certainly simpler than trying to do the deep clean, as Aisha put it earlier, right? A deep clean is a really hard thing to do to know that you've done it right. Whereas starting fresh, and maybe when you finish your travels, you do a factory reset on that travel phone. So the next time you travel, you do it again, right? That I've spoken to people who are doing that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that everybody needs to do it, but that's not it's not an unreasonable approach. It requires a bit more planning, you know, before the travel, you need to think about who, you know, what information do I need? You know, we're very used to right now this idea that, oh, well, just, you know, we're carrying my brain in my pocket and that, like, I don't have to worry about any plans ahead. I don't need to worry about guidebooks. I don't need to worry about maps. Like, it'll all just be there. And here I'm saying, hey, maybe you need to do that. You know, you remember what it was like traveling in the 80s or 90s, yeah, where you had to plan ahead. You know, maybe we should be doing a little bit of planning.
We had to print the directions off a computer.
Exactly.
MapQuest, yes. It's funny. I mean, yes, not everybody can afford a new phone, but also I think many of us have a weird old iPhone in our closet somewhere that we never threw away that you're like, oh, you know, because they wouldn't let you redeem it or whatever. And it's just sort of sitting in a drawer because you're like, I don't want to throw it away because I'm afraid. And now maybe that becomes your travel phone. Yeah.
I think we're going to see that increasingly also as other countries do adopt these increasingly invasive searches and people traveling to countries where they're worried about bringing sensitive information. I think it goes both ways now. Again, it's this race to the bottom, but you know, it's expensive to have a travel phone, but maybe it's more worth it if you're traveling with really sensitive materials, if you're going to countries that don't respect human rights, it might be an investment that's worth it.
Another thing I want to ask you about sort of related to this is like, it's like we're ratting on ourselves. We're big brothering ourselves through like social media and through like, you know, sort of, it's not even protected in a group chat. You're bragging about how much you hate a political party or whatever. Freedom of speech is free speeching all the day on social media. You know, we're big brothering ourselves is what I'm really saying. So how much should we be worried about, like, you know, freedom of speech versus data privacy versus living our lives and, you know.
I think a lot of these pressures are really an attempt to squash dissent, right? We don't want you coming into the country if you've expressed bad opinions about our current administration, something like that. And so if we respond by not expressing negative opinions about the current administration, then success. Tick. Mission accomplished, right? So I'm very wary about telling people, don't talk about the things that you want to talk about. Don't take public stands, because that's doing the work of the would-be censors for them. At the same time, I do think that we need to think a little bit more cautiously about all of the stuff that we post, not because I think you shouldn't be able to say things that are critical. I think that kind of dissent is really important, and I don't want to live in a society where people don't do it. But that doesn't mean that you need to take, you know, a picture of all of your friends and post that on Facebook. Just, you know, you had the fun night out, because again, you don't know what the, you know, you don't know if your friend has a warrant out. You don't know if your friend, what their immigration status is. You know, these aren't things that everybody talks about. We do need to be taking that stuff more seriously, but I'd be very hesitant to tell people that they should stop expressing themselves.
Sure, sure. There, I know there's a handful of legal cases in the works right now that have to do with digital privacy. Are there cases that us regular people should be following or paying attention to?
That's a good question. I'm actually genuinely thinking about it.
Good. That's good. I every now and again, I like to get a good question
in
there.
I think for people interested in device searches, there are some pending cases. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes New York, is going to be deciding the issue in the coming months, most likely. The Third Circuit, which covers New Jersey, Pennsylvania, has a case that it may decide that issue. The Supreme Court might take up the issue in the next few years. So I think for those people who are interested in the legality of border device searches, there's a lot of movement in the courts, and we may actually get more opinions in the coming months or years. And then I think we're likely to see more challenges to social media surveillance as well, and the use of AI to sort of digest massive, massive amounts of social media content that no human could individually review. But with AI, it's easy enough for the government to just say, oh, we outsourced this review, and now we're going to start taking punitive action against people based on what the AI identified as threats, right? And I think we'll start to see that challenged in a variety of contexts, whether it's use in immigration vetting, whether it's used to initiate domestic investigations against people, student discipline, what have you. I think we'll start to see some cases that go through the courts that really talk about how using AI in this way to just like digest massive amounts of information and then make these snap judgments about people and then have these consequences for their lives is so detrimental to First Amendment rights, to just due process. The idea that we're entitled to, you know, a human to review decisions that have these major consequences for us, whether it's decisions about our immigration status or other decisions. And, you know, and no one's arguing with the AI right now, because in most cases, we don't even know the AI has made the decision. So there's no meaningful opportunity to defend yourself. No one's getting brought before like the robots in court to say, hey, robot, you got it wrong. And that's a pretty fundamental part of due process that I think the courts will have to step in and say, we're losing that the way that the government's currently using AI, and we need to bring that due process back.
Is there anybody, I mean, sometimes we want to, you know, I think we get frustrated with our elected officials and specifically Congress. Is there anybody in Congress that you see as somebody who's like understands this issue and is advocating for us? I'll take your silence as a no, okay.
I think that there are, here's what I'll say. I don't have specific names for you, but I actually think that there is bipartisan interest in this. There are, of course, all kinds of challenges with getting anything through Congress right now. But in my experience, and I think the ACLU's experience, concerns about privacy are bipartisan. And so it's about finding a coalition that can actually make something happen and making privacy protections a priority vis-a-vis everything else that's going on.
I would also say that, you know, I would love it. I would love to hear one of the members of Congress stand up and say these border searches are wrong and start building that coalition explicitly. You know, this is what elected representatives should be doing, because the people who are affected by this is everybody who's coming into the country. That means, you know, US citizens, but also friends and family of, you know, it's everybody. So we need that kind of leadership. I'm not seeing a ton of it either.
Is this where you declare you're running for Congress? Is that what you're about to do right now?
No, that is not my job.
I was about to invite you to make your announcement here on the At Liberty podcast, but here we're going to wrap out with the lightning round. Start with you, Aisha. If listeners can remember one thing from this conversation, what should it be?
Every little thing you do to protect your privacy counts. You don't have to be perfect. Just take one step tomorrow and that's good.
DKG?
I think actually what I would say is make backups. If you do get it, you know, before you cross the border, if you do have your devices seized because you've declined to provide a password, you're gonna, you know, if they're off and locked, the chances are, and you've used a good password, they probably can't get into them. But if they still have your devices, you're kind of stuck. So think about your backups and make sure you can restore from your backups. So I would just add that as a bit of guidance to folks who are considering, you know, who are considering traveling to countries who don't take people's digital privacy seriously. That's, you know, this is a good practice in general. And, you know, that kind of, you know, making backups, setting up disappearing messages, all of these sorts of things, these steps are baseline steps that you can take that will help you generally in your digital life. And they also help you as you cross the border. And I guess the one other thing is just that reminder that, like, the data on your phone, the data on your laptop is not just your data. It's everybody who you've ever talked with, right? And so we have a responsibility to each other to take these things more seriously. Not, you know, it's one thing for me to say, you know, I think I can run across this 5-lane highway and I probably won't get hit. It's another thing if I'm holding somebody's hand and trying to get across that highway. I'm going to take that decision differently. And I think we have to remember that we are, you know, this is a team sport here, and we have to sort of take these steps. Each step that you take is a step that levels you up, and you're not going to get it perfect, as Aisha said, but the more you can do that, the more you're actually helping your friends and your family and your community as well as yourself.
Aisha, do you think if there's one thing somebody can do, what do you think about after they hear this conversation?
I think consider the digital trail you leave in your life generally, and whether that's you decide tomorrow to have disappearing messages, or you decide to opt out of a particular service you use that's collecting your data, just reconsider the trail you leave.
Two more questions. What's giving you hope right now? DKG, you seem like a very hopeful person. What's giving you hope right now?
I don't feel like a hopeful person. I feel like I see all the losses. The things that give me... The things that give me hope is that I do see folks building tools that are usable, that take these questions into consideration, where the folks who build the tools have locked themselves out of their users' data. You know, not every tool does that. A lot of these organizations, you know, the startups are all going to try to monetize their user base, and for that they need access to the data. But there are some groups that are building tools that take this seriously, and that does give me hope. You know, people need to use them. They need to be, you know, they need to be adoptable. I don't care about the fanciest, most impressive crypto. I care about the stuff that can be used by as many people as possible. There are folks who are building that kind of thing out there that do give me hope.
For me, I think it's the fact that there is a lot of attention on these kinds of searches and invasions of digital privacy, the fact that there's been so much media attention on it, which shows that actually people do care, because the media wouldn't cover it and it wouldn't get so much attention and we wouldn't get so many inquiries if people didn't care about privacy. So I think that this conversation that young people don't care about privacy or people prefer convenience, I don't think that that's true. It's all obviously very contextual and people need convenience in their daily lives. But I think the coverage of this issue shows that people really care, and that gives me hope.
Finally, where can listeners keep up with you and your work? Aisha?
Probably the ACLU website.
All the ACLU people say the same thing. They all say they all just plug the ACLU website.
I'm not on X. I'm not on Facebook. So.
No, you're doing the right thing. You're doing the right thing. It's just funny. It's like they have me ask this question, and it's always the ACLU people. I don't know, ACLU.org? Like, but which is totally acceptable. Totally acceptable. DKG?
I would second that answer, but I also think for folks who are interested in the underlying questions about how these systems actually work and how they're applied, you know, in a usable space, I think there's a bunch of different technical places that you can look and see, you know, how some of these things are happening, you know, and that's not for everyone, you know, there's technical standard spaces and software development spaces are kind of dense to get into. But if you're someone who has thought about these questions, if you're the kind of person who helps your friends get involved in using tools that are safer and healthier for the community, I would recommend that you try to join communities of like-minded people and talk with them about it. And these are kinds of communities that I'm involved in as well, right? These are either standards setting spaces or, you know, development or user-focused groups. If you decide you're going to be the only one in your family to use Signal, that's not going to help you very much because your family is all still using SMS, texting back and forth. But if you decide you're going to use Signal and you manage to get your friends on it, talk to other folks who are using it, help people figure it out, and, you know, get involved and report back like that. I recommend following. That's the kind of place that I think is worth following on top of the ACLU website.
Still, we're ending on recommending Signal. It's just obviously the big thing is don't invite an adversarial journalist to whatever Signal chat you set up. Signal's not the problem. It's the user end of inviting the adversarial party to your group chat. Don't do that. Although if you're the federal government, please keep doing that because that helps us out a lot. Thank you for talking to me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guests, Aisha Bhandari and Daniel Khan Gilmore.
And thanks to you for listening. And remember, friends, friends help friends stay in the fight. Join us, ACLU.org. You didn't need to know that, but I told you anyway. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. It really means a lot to us. Give us 5 stars. We're doing the big work here. Until next time, I'm your host, W. Kamau Bell. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU. This episode was executive produced by the ACLU's Jessica Herman-Weitz and Gwen Schroeder and Who Knows Best Productions, me, Kelly Rafferty, PhD, and Melissa Hudson-Bell, PhD, and was recorded at the Great Skyline Studios in Oakland, California. What's up, Brian? This show is edited and produced by Erica Ghetto and Mariah Gossett for Good Get.
Special thank you this week to my hometown radio station, KALW, and David Boyer.